to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Rich Halfley, and he'll be answering your most important questions on making the right connection between natural insects and artificial flies. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Rick Halfley about making the right connection between natural insects and artificial flies. Our approach is simple. Education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like shortline nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Rick, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Rick's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving a copy of Rick's latest book, Nymph Fishing, Rivers, and Streams, courtesy of Stackpole Books. If you'd like to find out more about Stackpole Books, go to www.stackpolebooks.com. That's stackpolebooks.com. So here's how you can win Rick's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and be the first to submit the answer, and you might win Rick's book, Nymph Fishing, Rivers, and Streams. Well, tonight, our guest is Rick Halfley. I'm sorry, Rick. Rick caught his first trout on a fly at the age of 12 on a spring creek in Missouri. His interest in fly fishing and aquatic insects fully developed after he moved to the Pacific Northwest in 1969. Since then, he has traveled throughout the West and beyond fishing for wild native trout, collecting and studying insects upon which they feed. Rick has a Master of Science degree in aquatic entomology from Oregon State University and worked as a professional aquatic biologist for over 30 years. In the course of both his professional work and his fly fishing, Rick has spent more than 40 years observing aquatic insects and fish communities in creeks, streams, rivers, and lakes. Rick has written articles for scientific journals and penned the aquatic entomology column for American Angler magazine for over 30 years. Books to his credit include An Angler's Guide to Aquatic Insects and Their Imitations, The Complete Book of Western Hatches, that he did with Dave Hughes, Western Mayfly Hatches, again, written with Dave Hughes' help, and most recently, Nymph Fishing, Rivers, and Streams. He's also instructed in 8 fly fishing DVDs, starting with the 1983 Scientific Angler release of Anatomy of a Trout Stream. His most recent DVD, Advanced Tactics for Emergers and Dries, was just released by Laughing River Productions in October of 2011. Rick is currently a member of the Freshwater Trust, the Native Fish Society of Oregon, the Western River Conservancy, and Water Watch. He's also been awarded life membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and the Fly Fishers Club of Oregon for his contributions to fly fishing literature. He lives in Portland, Oregon with his wife, Carol. Well, Rick, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger. And I'll just point out that my last name, right? My last name gets mispronounced more often than Latin insect names, so don't worry about that.
I'm going to try to deal with that later. No, I'm not. I'm going to let you deal with it. But it is Halfley, right?
Yes, just like you're calling a flea, Halfley.
A Flea, okay.
There you go.
So we got lots of good questions tonight, Rick, and I think this
yeah.
is a struggle that many of us go through all the time, is trying to figure out the connection, you know, between what's in the river and what's in our fly box, or what should be in our fly box. So let's just dive in here, because we've got a lot to cover, and I think it'll keep us busy for the next 90 minutes.
Great.
You know, the book we were talking about, your book, Nymph Fishing, Rivers and Streams, in that book you spent a lot of time talking about, you know, trout behavior and what they're doing and where they're doing it in the river. And I thought maybe we'd kind of start there, and maybe you can kind of relate how important this will be to fly selection, and then later on, or very shortly, we'll be digging in deeply into that. But I thought maybe that would be a good place to start, because I think it might have a bearing.
That sounds great, yeah. Well, I guess the short answer is I think it's pretty critical, actually, the behavior of the trout and how that's going to reflect the kind of fly patterns you're going to choose, and especially how you're going to fish them. A lot of times when it comes to nymph fishing, the behavior is a little simpler, I think, because basically they're looking for something to eat and they're grabbing it in their mouth, checking it out and eating it. And it's more of a situation of trying to find where the trout are eating when you're nymph fishing as much as their behavior in terms of how they're actually feeding. But when the trout start getting closer to the surface and feeding during a hatch, that feeding behavior can be rather confusing and definitely critical to the type of fly pattern you're going to use and how you fish it. So, for example, maybe a spinner fall happens in the morning, mid-morning sometime, and the behavior of that is going to be very subtle rises, small, soft rises in eddies and soft water, and they're taking that spinner right in the film. And they're very slow and very deliberate about it. But maybe then that evening you get a caddis hatch, and their behavior is going to be completely different. They're going to be very active, energetic, potentially taking pupa subsurface with vigorous rises or slashing at some adults at the surface just before they get off the water. And so it's going to be a completely different, obviously, fly pattern you're using, but also your presentation is going to be completely different, more of a swing, twitches, some action to the fly, where if you give it any sort of drag with that spinner pattern in the morning, you're probably dead in the water in terms of catching any fish. So that behavior, you know, is radically different, and there's all sorts of, you know, combinations of that in between depending on the type of insect that's actually emerging. One of the things I'll probably mention several times as we go through these questions is that it really can benefit any situation that you're struggling figuring out what's going on to just start observing. Set your fly rod down and just look at the water, at what's going on, whether it's the bug behavior you're observing or the fish behavior. It's really important just to spend some time observing the behavior of what's happening rather than just immediately changing flies out of your fly box and making more casts.
Yeah, I don't know how many times I've heard that from guests, and yet I know for myself I don't spend enough time observing. And you're always it just seems like you're always so anxious to get your line
exactly.
in the water, you know?
Yeah, especially during a hatch, because you think, oh, it's going to end, and the fish are going to stop rising, and I better get the right fly out there soon, and you just start this rotation of patterns out there, but it can be well served to spend a little time just watching the fish.
Yeah, I know. It's a little lake down from my house here that I fish in. It's a little private lake, and I remember, you know, I took that to heart one night when there was just before dusk, and caddis were coming down and dipping in the water and stuff. But I thought the fish were taking adults, and then I realized they weren't, you know, by just watching them very closely and realized no mouths were coming out of the water.
Right.
So I see these fins going around, cruising around, you know. I'm going, you know, and I'm struggling. And then when I stopped to really analyze what was going on, it made it easy. I put on some emergers on, and boom. Fish right away, you know?
So. Yeah. And the other thing, you know, as we get older, our eyesight isn't the greatest. And I find it absolutely amazing what you can see if you just have a small travel pair of binoculars with you. And mm-hmm. just have them around your neck or in your vest. Look out there on the water 30 feet away from where you're standing. And you'll be amazed at what you see on the water. And how you can pick out what the fish are actually doing if you just have a little pair of binoculars with you.
Mm-hmm.
Good idea. Yeah.
Saved my bacon on many occasions, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and part of, you know, and looking at your book on the trout behavior, too, was, and to me, this goes to, you know, this next area we're talking about, fly selection and matching, or maybe not matching, but just, you know, where these fish are in the water column, or, you know,
right,
what is in the water by them may make the difference as to trying to determine, you know, from a nymphing standpoint, trying to determine what's going on. And it seemed, you know, from your book that there were, you know, all the different lies, you know,
right,
big difference right, as well.
Right. And reading the water with nymph fishing is one of the things I think people really have to learn to get good at nymph fishing is reading the water. Because you can spend a lot of time putting your fly, your nymphs in places where there's not likely to be a fish holding. The other thing with nymph fishing that I've spent a fair bit of time talking about in the book is the drift behavior of insects. And we don't need to get into a lot of it here, but just that behavioral drift of many insect nymphs go through at specific periods of the day, which peak at right at sunrise and again at sunset, and there'll often be another peak in the middle of the night. These peak periods of drift activity of nymphs obviously means there's a lot more food drifting in the water column for trout to eat then. And so if you're thinking about nymph fishing, these are really great times to go out and nymph fish if there's nothing else going on to suggest a different, you know, approach.
What causes that?
Well, it's just a situation where if, you know, if you're bugged out on the bottom and there's going to be situations where you're on a rock as a little bug where it's too crowded, maybe there's, you know, 200 net spinning caddis on one rock. Well, they're not getting enough food because they're too crowded. So those caddis can just let go and drift to another rock downstream, or maybe a predator comes along. But this behavioral drift is just the way that insects apparently maintain distribution across the stream bottom and keep themselves finding niches that are more amenable, you know, to feeding and avoiding predators. And it's a change in light conditions at those morning and evening periods that trigger this drift behavior. Mm-hmm. These nymphs are very sensitive to changes in light. And so it's just the change in light intensity that apparently triggers this mass drift that occurs. There's some drifting going on all the time, but this mm-hmm. more peak in drift activity is triggered by changing in light conditions. So
maybe
it's pretty fascinating.
Feel safer or something, just like fish do when the light.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating, and it happens in any stream, whether it's a spring creek or a tailwater or freestone or a little creek in the headwaters or a big river. This peak drift periods occur year-round, any kind of stream you're fishing. So there's been a lot of studies done on it. It's pretty interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely. So it pays to get there early. It pays to stay late.
Yeah. When it comes to nymph fishing, those are going to be great times to be out there and drop on a nymph, and fish are going to be looking for things.
Yeah. Now, we've got lots of questions. So let's dive into this on both designing and selecting flies. And so let me start out with Brian from Lee Summit, Missouri here. He says, hello, Roger and Rick. I was wondering how much as fly fishermen do we overanalyze our fly selection? With the exception of high-pressured popular streams such as the Frying Pan, San Juan, South Platte, and other popular streams where highly educated fish have seen it all multiple times throughout the season due to constant pressure, we tend to put too much importance on color selection, shuck or no shuck, antron wing or CDC, or are we better off with a fly box with a size selection of Adams parachutes, elk hair caddis, hares, ears, prince nymphs, and midges, and making them work?
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. It's easy with all the information and new fly patterns that we get in magazines and books and all the new materials that people experiment with and create some really, you know, great patterns. But it's really easy to get caught up in all of those little nuances of what kind of shell back I'm going to put on this nymph or, you know, what kind of new body material I'm going to use on this dry fly, as opposed to just simplifying a series of flies that will work for a variety of hatches and situations. And I have to say, over the years that I've been fishing, which is over 40 years now, my fly boxes, if you look at the selection of flies, is pretty simple. I mean, there's not a lot of complicated patterns. There's not a huge variety of styles. I've kind of zeroed in on styles that I like that work for the intended purpose and can cover a range of different insects by just varying their size or color. So I've kind of gravitated to specific styles of flies that I really think work well and vary those in size and colors for different hatches. And then I can fish them for the, you know, certain situations, whether it's a caddis pupa pattern I like or a spinner pattern and so forth. So I tend to agree with them that it's easy to overanalyze fly selection and carry more flies than you're ever going to probably need and get a little confused by it all. And I think you can be well served by simplifying the styles and making sure you've got a good range of sizes, because I think that's really important, and a range of colors that cover sort of the dark to light shades and browns, greens, or browns and olives and some yellows in there. So doesn't mean you're not going to need quite a few flies in your vest, but it doesn't need to get overwhelming.
Right, right. Yeah, I know we're always faced, especially when you go to a, you know, a new area, isn't it? Maybe jump in the boat or wade into the stream next to your guide.
Right, right.
You know, or just prior to that, you know, you're asked, well, do you have a chartreuse triple-double whammy? And do I need one of those?
Exactly, exactly.
You feel like not going to catch any fish unless you use exactly what the guide has given you, you know, is telling you to use. You know?
Yeah, I know. There are those local patterns that obviously, you know, just work extremely well in a particular time of year in a certain place. Well, you know, I've traveled a lot, and I've been in South America, fished in Chile and Argentina. And, of course, being a bug person, I always spend a little time kicking around looking at the bugs that are there, before I start fishing. And that gives me a good clue about what the dominant things are around for fish to eat. And it's amazing, the flies I carry for fishing, you know, streams in here in Oregon or the West in general, will be patterns that work just about everywhere I go. And there may be a specific pattern they have that the guide will say, put this on, and it generally is going to work. But I've also found that later in the day, when the guide's not looking, I'll put on the fly that I've been looking at, you know, when I kicked around on the rocks, and sometimes it outfishes the one that they're recommending.
Yeah.
It's not often the case you do better than the guide's suggestion, but the point is that there's a lot of similarity across the board in the dominant insects that live in trout streams. So, you know, whether you fish in Montana or Pennsylvania, there's going to be a lot of overlap in the kind of insects that are out there. It'll be different species, but the general characteristics are going to be pretty similar.
Yeah. We need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Rick more about making that right connection between the naturals and the artificial flies. Fun Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. It's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Rick Hafley, I'm not going to get it here, Rick, about making that right connection. So if you'd like to ask us a question, just go to our homepage, fill out that form, and send us in your question, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Rick, what I always ask my guests at this point in the show, you know, what's happening in your fly fishing world? What are you up to? Whether it be commercial or not commercial or whatever. I know you've got a pretty recent project you've got going, and why don't you tell us about what's going on?
Yeah, probably the thing I'm spending a fair bit of time on right now is a project that myself, Dave Hughes, and Skip Morris, who you've both, I know both of those have been on your show in the past, three of us started an online magazine called Hooked Now just about a year ago. And so it's online subscription. It comes to you via email. It comes out every other month. And so that's something that we're trying to, you know, kind of stay up with technology here and put something out like that on the Internet. So it's been a fun project for the three of us to do. And if anyone's interested, you just go to hookednow.com, and you can see all about it. There's a free issue on online you can read and subscribe if you're interested. So the other thing most recently is what you've mentioned at the opening is that the DVD called Advanced Tactics for Emergers and Dries just came out in October. So that's the most recent new project I've finished. And over the next few months, I'll be traveling and giving some talks. I'll be in Denver at the Fly Show this coming weekend and in Calgary at the end of the month and some other things going on in the Seattle area. So the winter months are a good time when I get out there and travel and do some programs. So that's the main stuff. But the magazine has been our main project, and it's been a lot of fun.
Now, are there any other websites or anything that you want to share that where people can find your books? Or
yeah, the other main one, thank you, is Laughing Rivers, www.laughingrivers.com, and that's where all the DVDs and books are available for purchase. So anybody's
okay,
interested,
great.
They can go there. And then I have my own website, just Rick Haefeli. If anybody Googles my name, they'll get there. And I've got a bug blog, basically, where about once or twice a month I put something up on some interesting aspect of entomology and fly fishing, and often have a little video attached to it as well.
Cool. Sounds good. Great resources.
Yeah. There's a lot out there, so I appreciate the fact people have a lot to choose from. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, in this information age, yeah, there's all kinds of things that we have. More than we can consume, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, definitely. But everybody's got their little twist, and there's always something new to learn, that's for sure.
Well,
we've got a couple of questions that came in here on the Internet. I want to run by you here. One happens to be Tom from Idaho wants to know if that behavioral drift also happens in the wintertime.
It does. Yeah, it does. So obviously the time of day is different because sunset and sunrise
right.
is quite different. But, yes, it's the same connection with sunrise and sunset, and it's the drift is occurring in the winter also.
Okay. And Jim from Jefferson City, Missouri, wants to know, which Missouri spring creek did you catch your first trout at?
Bennett Springs.
Bennett Springs. There you go, Jim.
Yeah. Beautiful.
I don't know.
Beautiful place.
That's where you grew up?
I grew up in Illinois, and I had an uncle who lived in Missouri, and we'd go down there on vacations occasionally, and he was a fly fisherman, and first one to put a fly rod in my hand, and when I was about 10 or 11, and got me out there and got me keeping a fly in the water more than the trees, I guess. Bennett Springs is a spring creek there that has some nice trout in it. Very pretty place.
Let me see if I can see if this makes sense here. Thomas and Redmond. So does this light condition affect, I guess he says, you know, if cloud cover occurs, or is it just a certain amount of time? I think what he's trying to ask is, you know, if it's a cloudy day versus a sunny day, does this behavioral drift change, or is it just about?
Yeah. There would be some effect of that. Usually that peak and behavioral drift lasts a couple hours in the morning and a couple hours in the evening. If it's a real cloudy day, you might get less of a peak and the period of time might extend a bit. But there's still going to be some noticeable peaks in the morning right at sunrise and right at sunset. It may not be as extreme if it's been a real dark, cloudy day.
Okay. Another question here from Dylan in Pennsylvania. And he says, when looking at a hatch chart that gives Latin names, is there a good cross-reference online to translate to artificial fly name? Example, Betis hatching January, March. What fly do I tie on?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not aware of a specific website that would have that, but just almost any time if you Google a Latin name anymore, when I've done that, you come up with a fly fishing website that tends to interpret that into a fly pattern or a fly fishing situation. some of the books out there that have been written also include a lot of common names, maybe for a hatch, not necessarily a specific fly pattern. Betus is a good example because one of the challenges you run into, Betus is a genus of mayfly that has about 15 or 20 species in it, and depending on the region of the country, you're going to have a very different size and color of blue-winged olive. So the common name for that is blue-winged olive, but it may be a 18 olive blue-winged olive for a Betus bicaudatus in Colorado, and it might be a size 14 tan blue-winged olive in Pennsylvania or something. So that's one of the challenges that you have with common names is that they usually aren't tied to a specific species. They're tied usually to a group of species. Just because fly fishing, you're not able to identify these things at the species level.
Right. Yeah, I noticed, you know, in your book, it's like on page 56 and 57, you have two water samples, one from a large tail water and one from a medium-sized spring creek. And the first thing is blue wing olives with two different species.
Right.
And so they're right there, yeah.
Right.
But that, you know, to the normal guy like me, and like you just said, it really more has to do with sampling and matching rather than really knowing the name.
Exactly. You don't need to put a Latin name to it to have success. Fortunately, it's a good thing. But it does help to, you know, have some idea because if you want to go read about it in a book later and find out, well, geez, do these nymphs emerge underwater or in the surface film? What patterns have been used in the past? You kind of have to have some idea whether you were looking at a blue-winged olive or a pale morning dun, you know, to figure that out.
Sure, yeah. I suppose a lot of local shops and so forth, you know, that guide on the specific river have a better idea, too, and you could probably just ask them, and they could probably steer you in the right direction.
Yep.
Another question from Steve Schweitzer in Colorado, and Steve was on our show. He wrote a book on fishing Rocky Mountain National Park.
Oh, nice.
He says, I made a serious hobby of imitating insects with easy-to-tie facsimiles, particularly Rocky Mountain National Park and high-altitude fishing. But what I still fail to understand is why a fly that resembles nothing natural, such as an orange foam hopper or pink-slash-purple nymph, fool so many fish, particularly in high-mountain venues. I can surmise many theories, but would love your take on why not matching the hatch can be just as productive as having the perfect imitation.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I saw this question, the thing that I guess popped into my head was the fact he's talking about high-altitude streams, which tend to have low productivity when it comes to the amount of insect life in them. And we run into the same thing here in our coastal mountains in Oregon and on down the Pacific coast. There's quite a range of productivity in streams when you start looking at water chemistry, just naturally occurring differences of conditions. And in streams where you have low productivity because there's not as much nutrients in the stream, and certainly in high-altitude areas, you've got a very short season where much sunlight's getting in those streams to bump up the productivity. There's not a lot of insect life. And those fish in those systems really have to be aggressive when it comes to eating. They aren't sitting there debating about what to take or not to take. They want to be the first one of their buddies to get to what anything looks like food. And so those attractor-type flies, something that stands out, easy to see, are going to be something they'll tend to respond to extremely well in those low-productivity systems. When you get into rich streams, you know, classic spring creeks, Henry's Fork, Silver Creek, Green River in, you know, Utah, many others that are back east that are really rich spring creeks, you have an abundance of food, and there the fish have a very different strategy for survival. When you have lots of food to eat, it's a better strategy to be picky because they spend less energy bouncing around, grabbing that little food here and that big food there. If they focus on one thing and concentrate on it, they can actually spend less energy and get more food for the amount of energy they spend. So I would say, given his situation in the Rocky Mountain Park there, it's largely due to the low productivity of the water.
And that I did an interview with Tom Rosenbauer from Orvis on fly fishing small streams, and he said almost verbatim what you just said as well. He said those fish are just ready to eat anything.
they can't be choosy. Yeah,
there's just not the hatches going on. There's no
insects. Exactly. Like you say. If you start looking at the insect life closely, you know, it becomes really apparent when you do a tick screen in a Rocky Mountain National Park, which I've fished, not a lot, but I have fished there, versus, say, the Green River in Utah. I mean, it's like, holy cow, there's no comparison to the amount of food
that
there.
I watched that DVD that you had in your book there, and when you did those samplings, what river was that?
A lot of that was on the Deschutes River in Central Oregon.
That's full of bugs, isn't it?
Very productive stream and a very
good
trout.
Like one of everything in that tray.
Yeah. It's a great trout stream. So.
Yeah. Okay, Bill in Taos, New Mexico asks, he says, well, stoneflies are unable to swim and float helplessly in the water column. So why are most stonefly nymph patterns tied very heavy to bounce along the bottom?
Good question. So my thought on this is that stonefly nymphs are bottom-dwelling critters. They want to stay on the bottom. When they get up in the water column, they don't want to stay there, and they're going to try to get down back to the rocks. Now, they aren't good swimmers, and they're not completely neutrally buoyant. They're going to have a little bit of density that's going to cause them to sink, but they aren't super heavy in terms of neutral buoyancy, so they don't sink real rapidly. But they're starting off from the very bottom of the stream bed whenever they get washed off the rocks. If you were to fish a fly pattern that has the same kind of density as a natural nymph, and you throw it in at the surface where your fly is starting, it would never sink to the bottom. It would never have a chance to get close to the bottom because it just wouldn't be heavy enough. So because our flies start by being cast from above the water and land on the water, they have to get down near the bottom somehow. And the only way to do that is to add weight to it. And the majority of fish that are feeding on, say, stonefly nymphs are going to be looking for them close to the bottom, even though the nymphs get bounced up into the water column by, you know, currents that are in the more aggressive areas of a stream. There's currents washing them up into the column. Still, the trout are looking close to the bottom where the majority of them are going to be drifting. So you got to get your flies down.
That's probably where you're going to get your hookup anyway, right? So, I mean, if it ends up being too high in the water column, they're probably not looking at it anyway. And
I can't tell you how many times I've fished through a run, fairly turbulent run, and I haven't done very well, and go back to the head of it and just add more split shot to my nymph fishing rig and immediately start catching fish. And it was just by getting my fly a foot deeper in that run. So usually when I'm nymph fishing, I want my nymphs bouncing on the rocks. And because we're starting at the surface and have to sink them through the water column, we have to put some weight on it. And the natural nymphs are starting at the bottom to begin with.
Right. Yeah. Chuck in Santa Rosa, California, says, Rick, do trout wise up to frequently used flies and take them less often? If so, how do we explain the evergreens like Adam's, Hare's Ear, et cetera? If not, how do we explain the patterns which are red hot for a year or two and then seem to fade in effectiveness?
Yeah. From my experience, I would say that fish do wise up. But it tends to be more prominent on streams that have a lot of pressure and, you know, where it's catch and release, which, of course, a lot of trout streams are now. So, you know, where you have a situation where there's a lot of anglers and it's catch and release, trout will definitely wise up, become more selective. They'll also become much more schooled about drag or seeing a leader. So, you know, needing to go to fluorocarbon and being really, really critical about your presentation can become more important on those heavily fished waters. So, I think fish wise up. and a certain pattern can lose its effectiveness. You know, the reason I think patterns like the atoms and hare's ears and stuff tend to work for year in and year out is because they represent a lot of different kinds of bugs that are out there. Hare's ear, depending on how it's tied and fished, can represent a caddis pupa, a pale morning dun nymph, a green drake nymph, a stonefly nymph. So, you know, it's just one of those styles of flies, like I was mentioning how I've simplified my fly box. It's one of those styles of flies that tied in different sizes can really be fished effectively for a lot of different insects. And so when you throw it out there, you know, it has a lot of opportunity to look like something the fish wants to eat. So I think that's why a lot of, you know, some of those patterns have just been effective forever. And there's some patterns that just kind of still, I don't know why, like a royal wolf. My goodness, you know, that fly can work in the middle of a good hatch and you're having trouble catching fish matching the hatch. You put on a royal wolf, throw it out there, and boom, the fish start taking it. I don't know why. I don't know why.
Yeah, it's like, you know, many times when we do these interviews and guests are asked, well, what's your top five flies you would take with you, and inevitably that parachute Adams always seems to end up on the list, you know.
Yeah,
kind of like royal wolf. It's like that for some reason that just thing works everywhere. And if all else fails, put that on it and her hair's there and you'll probably catch a fish.
Mm-hmm.
But
we've
got a question that came in on the internet. Susan in Winona, Minnesota says, my husband Ralph often rolls his eyes at my artistic flies. However, my Golden Girls, Vegas Girls, and Sparklies catch more than his entomologically correct flies. So what is the hubbub about being real, she has in quotes?
You know, this whole debate over attractor flies versus real imitative flies is an interesting one. And I don't think we can ever come up with an answer that probably satisfies everyone. Attractor flies work, and here's a good example. One experience I've had: Jim Schollmeyer, Dave Hughes, and I were fishing Spring Creek in Montana, and there was a midge hatch coming off, and it was this flat water fish feeding on like a size 20 midge, real selective situation, clear water, calm day, blah, blah, blah. And so Jim's out there, his little, you know, midge pupa, 7X tippet, drifting over these fish, and they're kind of some looking at it, some ignoring it, some taking it. Real, real technical fishing. So I, just to get his goat, I decide, well, I stand right next to him and I put on a big damselfly nymph, throw it out there right in the middle of these fish, and start stripping it back, and wham, I have a trout on. And, you know, I just had to laugh because I did it just to see what would happen if I could get, you know, Bug Jim, because he was doing all these right things with the selective trout. And I think it reflects the fact that these trout are wild creatures that are going to respond in a variety of ways. They're looking for food. They're looking for triggers that cause them to strike at something, and sometimes those triggers are territorial, so a bright fly might trigger a territorial reaction. Other time it's a very food-specific trigger, so you're trying to get the right kind of look on the surface with a dry fly with a spinner pattern. So there's different avenues to approach the fly fishing success because the trout have different triggers that are going to cause them to feed. Myself, I tend to look closely at the food forms and try to match them, but I know there's opportunities out there for people to put on attractor flies and do pretty well. There's no one way to catch fish, that is for sure.
Right, right. Well, we have another question on the internet. Mark Sheely, did I get that right, Mark? He says nobody ever gets his his name right either. he says, when you are fishing a new river and trying to match the hatch the best you can, but to no avail, do you ever use a seine to either select a nymph pattern or use this insect to help you tie patterns for that specific river?
Well, I do that all the time. In fact, I do that on rivers I fish routinely, like the Deschutes, which I kind of consider my home water. I fish more than most other places. I know the bugs in there quite well. I know the hatches quite well. So I have a good idea what to use, but I'll get over there and start fishing, and I'm not doing that great. I'll set my rod down, spend 30 minutes with a seine, collecting bugs, picking up rocks, shaking trees, and I usually come up with an idea about what fly I should switch to based on what I've just been looking at, put that other pattern on, and it tends to improve my success. What I often tell people in my workshops is that, you know, because we don't get enough time to fish as much as we'd like, go out there and fish for an hour the way you would normally start fishing. And if you're doing well, great. But if you're not, set your rod down and spend 30 minutes picking up rocks, shaking trees, and really observing what insect types are dominant, or if there's any feeding behavior, what it is. And that'll inform you about what other patterns might be better to put on. And then fish for another hour with those other patterns and see if you don't do better. And most of the time, people are going to do better. It also gives you a real sense of confidence that you've got a fly pattern on that makes sense. You know, if you just stand out there and go, God, I'm going to put this prince nymph on. I don't know why, but it worked 2 or 3 weeks ago or a month ago. I think it'll work today. Well, you throw it out there and you don't have necessarily a great deal of confidence. But if you've kicked over a bunch of rocks and you see just tons of net spinning caddis larvae and you've got a pattern that matches it, at least when I put on that imitation, I throw it out there, I go, this is going to work. You know, so I have a lot more confidence. But yeah, I do spend time seining, and it's partly to improve my fishing success, but it's also partly because I just enjoy the hell out of looking at insects.
Bugs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, hold on just a sec here, Rick, and we'll be right back, and I have something to follow up on that. So
great.
We'll be back in just a minute. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department, and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com, keeney.com. Or call their fly shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rick Haefeli and about making the right connection between natural insects and artificial flies. And if you'd like to ask Rick a question, send it in. Just go fill out that form on our homepage. I'll try to answer as many of them as possible. Rick, when you were doing that sampling on your DVD, you know, on the Deschutes there, that brings up an issue, you know, what you were just talking about. And a question here too. Tom Little in Idaho wants to know, you know, what you do when nothing is, how do you figure out what's happening when nothing is happening? And I'm assuming you would say shake the bushes and seine the river. But when you did that on the Deschutes, there was, I mean, I don't know, I'd have to go back and watch it again, but there must have been at least 10 different species of insects in that dish, right?
You're gonna find a variety. If it's a healthy stream, you're gonna find a good variety of insects, and it can be confusing to say, oh gosh, now, you know, which pattern is the right one? Which bug do I really imitate?
Which one do you pick?
Yeah, and that's really where some understanding of entomology can be a big advantage, because what you're looking for are insects that are the most abundant. So out of that variety of you collected, there's probably two or three that seem to jump out as being more abundant. But don't be swayed by the biggest, because usually the biggest are not going to be the most abundant. But anyway, even if they're tiny, look for the ones that are most abundant, just numerous. And then you need to look for the ones that are most available. And the availability is really a behavior characteristic. So if you happen to be collecting and seeing a lot of clinging mayflies, like a Western March Brown is a clinging nymph, they hang onto the rocks extremely well. and aren't getting in the water column where trout can see them, even if they're abundant. On the other hand, if you're seeing a good number of blue-winged olives, which is a little swimming mayfly, they get in the water column a lot during those drift periods in the morning and evening, but also throughout the day. And so they would be a good choice to pick a pattern to match if they're abundant in your tray. So those two factors, what's abundant and based on their behavior, is it available or not, will really inform you about what would be the best choice. And that's something I talk quite a bit about in the nymph fishing book, actually. I have a table in there that lists 90 different insects based on their most frequent availability to trout from studies that have been done. There's information out there on that. But it helps if you have a little bit of bug understanding when you look at bugs on a rock or in a tray about what kind of behavior that particular insect has and whether it's readily available to fish or not. But that's the key thing. Yeah.
We had Ralph in Parker, Colorado wrote in on the Internet, and then we also had a question from Ray in Florida, both asking about books and resources. Dennis in New York, Pennsylvania, and wanting to know about if there's any entomology courses designed for the fly tire fly fisherman. If not, why hasn't a biologist or entomologist designed a course for home study? Is there anything like that or particular books you would recommend?
I do workshops all the time on that sort of thing. I don't know of any online type of course out there. But that's an interesting thought. Book-wise, it's kind of a regional thing. So because of the variety of insects and fly patterns and situations, it's usually good to look for a book that's kind of specific to the region you live in. So if you're eastern or northeastern or even midwestern, there's some great books out there. There's Thomas Ames Jr. has a book called Hatch Guide for New England Streams, which is very good on that. Western, there's a whole slew of books for Western hatches. Dave Hughes, I'll plug his book he just came out with in October called The Pocket Guide to Western Hatches. And then the books he and I have done together, you mentioned already those. So I would say you need to look for a regional book. And also some books are more insect group specific. So like there's Dave and I did a book just on Western mayfly hatches. So that book is a big book just on mayfly hatches. There's another book that I like a lot called Caddis Super Hatches by Carl Richards and Bob Brendel. It's been out a while, but it's a hatch guide for caddis. There's other hatch guides out there on stoneflies. So there's no one book that I would say is going to cover everything for you, but there's some really good regional books and some really good books on specific groups. LaFontaine's book on caddisflies is still good. Thomas Ames Jr. came out with a book on caddisflies for the East. So that's how I'd approach it. And so you're going to end up with a library, I guess.
Well, and Dave Whitlock's book.
Aquatic Trout Food.
It's still
a good book.
And
then I did years ago The Angler's Guide to Aquatic Insects and Their Imitations. That's out of print now, but it's still available online as an e-book. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Back to our questions that came in earlier. Thomas Murphy in Redmond, Washington. There's a couple of questions, and this actually goes along with Ralph in Parker, Colorado, his question. But they're both asking about, what's more important, size, shape, color, pattern, presentation. And Thomas actually talks about the JSON fly system. He says that has very realistic, specific species, and wants to know, do you have to, I guess, get that exact? And, you had said earlier that it sounded like you were going more towards not necessarily totally realistic, but more representative.
Right, approach. More impression, yeah, right.
Yeah, impressionistic,
yeah. I'm not familiar with the JSON fly system specifically. I'll have to, he left a URL here. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah,
but,
I'm not either. But,
the
silicon mayfly legs, so.
I tend to think presentation is really a critical link to success because, you know, the old story is, you know, 10% of the fishermen catch 90% of the fish. And there's situations where, you know, you're standing next to the guy and he's catching fish and you're not and he's starting to feel bad. And he says, oh, here, take my rod and I'll take yours. And you switch rods and flies and lo and behold, he starts catching fish too and you're still not catching fish. You go, okay.
Yeah, I have a friend like that. I hate him.
Yeah, that didn't make me feel too good. So what's the deal there? Well, the deal is, they're presenting the fly differently. They're doing something subtle, perhaps, or not so subtle, but they're doing something different with presentation. You can have the absolute perfect fly pattern on. If your presentation isn't right, you're not going to touch a fish.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a rough representation of a fly pattern for the natural, and if your presentation is good, you're probably going to do okay, maybe not as well as the perfect pattern, but you're still going to do okay. In my feeling. So I think presentation is really the critical link there. But when it comes to picking a pattern, I worry more about size than color or other aspects. So, and especially nymph fishing, and I bring that up in my nymph book a lot too, we tend to pick big nymphs when we go to our fly box for nymph fishing. We aren't sure what's out there. We're going to put on that size 8 or 6 stonefly nymph and fish it along the bottom. But to be honest, most of the food trout see when it comes to nymphs are small, often 16s and 18s. That's the dominant size of food drifting out there in the water column. And so size of the nymph is really important, just as it is in dry fly fishing, in my estimation. And I asked Charlie Brooks this years ago. People aren't familiar with Charlie Brooks. He's passed away quite a few years ago, but he wrote the book Nymph Fishing for Larger Trout, and it was a great guide and fisherman in West Yellowstone. And I asked him the same question, and he said for nymph fishing, he thinks size is the most important aspect to imitate.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I would say the shape of the pattern, the silhouette. Is it skinny? Is it fat? Is it long? Is it short? So get the general shape right. And I don't worry about counting the number of legs or whether the legs have, you know, little knees tied in them like the natural or not. I personally don't think that's important, but I think the shape is important. And then color last, you know, and for color, I've got some really good examples in my slideshows where I have the same species of nymph, PMD nymph, collected on the same rock. One is a cinnamon red color, one's almost black. Same species. Same rock, same day. So, you know, they come in different colors naturally because it's like we have different hair color, different skin colors. Insects come in different colors of the same species, too. So I don't worry as much about color, but I do worry about size and the general shape. And then last, you know, you got to have the presentation right. So
which makes sense, too. It would seem that with all the you know, the different depths, the sunlight, how it's hitting the river. Even
right.
If you had two of exactly the same color, they might appear differently as they're floating down the stream.
And whether you use synthetic dubbing of type A or synthetic dubbing type B, it's going to look different when it gets wet. You know, its colors will change slightly differently when it gets wet. So all those things when it comes to color really is kind of unknown how that's actually turning out when a trout sees it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We know on some of the attractor patterns or like, you know, baitfish patterns, well, there it's more of a, you know, a flash you're looking for as opposed
to,
that's a different kind of conversation. But,
and I do think that flash, though, is really important in emerging insects. So when a mayfly is swimming up to hatch or a caddis pupa is swimming up to the surface to hatch, it has a very distinct, or a midge pupa, they have a very distinct silver kind of sheen to them, almost a transparent silver look because of the air that's starting to escape under the exoskeleton that's going to allow them to split out of that exoskeleton quickly when they get to the surface. And that air that they purge out of their body basically to help them release from their exoskeleton gives that silvery, sparkly color or characteristic. And I think that's why these patterns that have been LaFontaine Sparkle Pupa or Antron or some of the new material they're using that's packing material for electronics that's kind of transparent but shiny is really good stuff to use for these emerging patterns.
There's another question in here. Otis in Reno wanted to know about texture and feel. He says, I'm thinking that nymphs made from a hard material like wire would be rejected quicker, where something softer like plastic would feel more like the real thing and consequently give us an edge by staying in the fish's mouth longer.
Yeah, I would say there's probably something to that. Although, as I think about it, one of my favorite nymphs, the green rockworm pattern, is tied with crystal flash body, which is kind of a hard, it is hard, and there's nothing soft about it, and that's one of my favorite nymphs. But I've read and I've seen other people advocate, you know, kind of the latex-bodied nymphs because they have a little softer feel. I wouldn't rule out the fact, you know, that that may allow fish to hold it in their mouth a little longer. I have spent a fair bit of time snorkeling and watching fish behavior underwater and watching people fish, watch how fish react to their flies while I'm underwater. And when you're nymph fishing, it's absolutely unbelievable how quickly a nymph will bring a fly into its mouth and spit it out. It's so fast you can't really see it. And so... I guess maybe I'm partly answering his question by saying anything that you can do to keep that in the fish's mouth a little longer is a good thing. But in any case, I think fish are bringing a pattern into their mouth and spitting it out really quickly when you're nymph fishing, probably with whatever kind of nymph you're using.
I think your
tactics, your technique for nymph fishing is really important.
Yeah. We did an interview with Ralph Cutter. He wrote the book called Fish Food.
Yeah, great book.
A couple months ago. And he, you know, he did a lot of underwater work like you did. And he said he was just amazed at what all they took in their mouth and spit out.
They're tasting or kind of trying out all kinds of stuff. Little twigs and pine needles and stuff are going in and out of their mouth. And then they see a caddis pupa and they don't spit it out. But they're, you know, just before that, they sucked in an alder catkin, you know, and then spit it out. So, yeah, they're kind of like testing the water all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And what so that makes it, you know, all the more important for us to be always checking to see if we're, because we're probably missing way more. I mean, we're always told that, but until Ralph started explaining how, you know, half the river was going through their mouths and in and out again, you know. I'm going, I don't know, I've probably missed way more fish in my life than I've ever caught, you know.
So I'm convinced when I'm nymph fishing, I'm getting 10 times as many strikes as I have any idea of.
I'm convinced
of that.
Lisa James in Park Hill, Oklahoma, she wrote in and she says, what are the key points on a fly that must look like a natural insect more than another point on a fly? For instance, the head, antenna, thorax, abdomen, tail, to get the fish to eat the artificial fly. So she's wondering if there's, I guess, what body parts are more important, do you think? Because you said pattern was important. So.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of a complicated question in a way because I think it would vary with where you're fishing the fly. So for example, if you're fishing a dry fly, it's going to be a different characteristic of the pattern that's going to be important as opposed to a pupa pattern or a nymph pattern. And so let's just kind of walk through that a little bit. If it's a dry fly, I think the important thing of the pattern is the natural sitting on the water heavily, so the body's in the water surface film, or real lightly, so it's just its kind of feet are on the water. And if the natural sits real lightly, so really the body doesn't touch the water much at all, you're going to need a hackled pattern that floats high on the water, something light. If it's a natural insect that has a lot more impression in the surface film, you're going to want a pattern like a foam-bodied pattern or some pattern that leaves a distinct impression of the abdomen on the surface. If it's a spinner pattern, the wings are a critical characteristic of what the fish see, and would be a critical part of that pattern when you're fishing it. Pupa, we've kind of touched on that. I think for pupa patterns, it's that shine, it's that sparkle from the air that they're putting out under their exoskeleton. So that's a characteristic of a lot of emerging insects that I think you'd want to capture with your fly pattern. And if it's a nymph pattern where the fish can see the whole bug easily, I think it's that size and shape. So that's really kind of the whole fly. I don't think the antenna specifically are critical or the tails are critical. I think it's the shape overall, short or long or skinny or fat, and then the size, making sure you get the size. So the answer has multiple, or that question has multiple answers, depending on where you're fishing the pattern.
I had a question coming on the internet. Danny asked about if you have any suggestions about making a cheap seine and how you go about using it, since we were painting the river.
Yeah, really. Get a couple of 1-inch or 2-inch wooden dowels, 4-foot-long wooden dowels at the hardware store, and some fiberglass window screen, and attach, you know, that window screen's about a 3 feet high, and you can stretch out about a 4 foot length of it, and attach that window screen to those two dowels, and you've got yourself a $5 kick screen that'll work extremely well. You can use just some staples and some duct tape to attach it to the dowels. You can get a little more creative with how you attach it, but it can be pretty simple. And that makes a very good kick screen. I do want to mention real quickly that you should check. Sometimes there's specific state laws about collecting insects. And so you should be sure you're not breaking any laws there. Normally it's not an issue if you're seining and putting them back in, but if you're going to start putting them in vials and taking them home or something, there are some requirements in some places. Also, just out of natural concern for the environment, you don't want to go out and collect in places where there's sensitive habitat, like aquatic plant beds and spring creeks or something, where 20 people munching through it with seines would kind of destroy the habitat. So make sure you use some common sense. In a healthy trout stream, if you sample a couple of square feet of stream bottom, you're not going to have any impact on the insect life. But, it can also be in areas where it could be a concern.
And make sure your buddy isn't fishing downstream of you.
Yeah, right. Or if there's trout spawning, that's the other thing. If you go out, and a lot of times, you know, where we seine is in the same kind of habitat trout spawn in. So you would definitely not want to do it around spawning times for fish.
I know. I don't know. I think it's actually illegal, but down on the San Juan River, they call it the San Juan Shuffle down there.
Right. That's right.
As you're walking through the stream, you look down river and you see, you know, 3 20-inch trout about 5 feet from you. Taking
now,
advantage.
Talk about learning, right? We said the trout learn about fly, but talk about a learned behavior. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, and he also asked about how you. Do it. So, you know, once
you hold it, you're going to be out in a riffle. Usually you need to be where there's some current. Doesn't have to be fast, but you need some current. And you're going to place the net perpendicular to the bottom, spread out, and then you're going to stand upstream. And with your feet, you're going to kick about a 2-square-foot area fairly vigorously. And you can also, if you have two people, one person can hold the net and the other person can use their feet and also take their hands and pick up the cobbles from the bottom and rub them. And then you're going to have the insects will float into the net from the current. And after you do that over a 2-square-foot area, 3-square-foot area, then gently lift the net out of the stream, carry it over to the bank, and lay it down. And then usually you're going to need a pair of tweezers. And I like to have a little white tray. You can use a Tupperware tray or a jar lid, but something where you can put about a half an inch of water in it and drop the nymphs that you see in the net into this water with a white background. And then you'll really see what these nymphs look like, the color, the size, how they swim. Are they just laying on the bottom, not moving, or are they good swimmers? That'll tell you about their behavior and their availability. And you'll get a sense of what kind of nymphs are the most abundant. So that's a very simple way to do it.
Mm-hmm. I know in your DVD too, you were actually dropping your fly
pattern. Yeah, it's great.
Size them and
when you do that with your nymph patterns, you'll be blown away at how big your flies are compared to the natural. I have not done this with anybody yet who hasn't said, "Holy crap, my nymphs are all too big."
Yeah. No, and you've made a point of that a couple of times tonight, and I'm going to be very careful of that in the future, because we always think, you know, like a double cheeseburger is better than a single cheeseburger.
Exactly.
Not necessarily the case.
No, it's not.
Wayne in Woodland, Washington wants to know, he says he owns and operates a fly company, and as you would imagine, your topics interest him. He says the question is related to UV materials and their effect on the success of fly patterns. Have you had any experience with UV materials?
I can answer this by just saying no. I haven't had any experience with UV materials, and the only thought I have is that I think it would be more important in lakes than in streams, where you're fishing at, you know, deeper depths, 20, 30 feet in a lake. A lot of the fishing in streams is 6 feet or less, and I think the effect of UV would be minimal to nil there, but I could see in lakes where it might become an issue, but I don't have any experience with it.
Okay. Rod, and this is kind of multi-part, so I'm going to try to pick some things out of his question here. Rod in Portland, right in your neck of the woods there. He says, when fishing freestone streams and tailwaters in the West, do you ever target fish with midge patterns in your nymphing, or are midges more prevalent in spring creeks? That's one part of his question.
Right. Well, midges are prevalent everywhere. Spring creeks, freestone, tailwaters, they're out there everywhere you fish, usually one of the most abundant critters in the stream. I personally don't target midges unless they're hatching. I know in Colorado and other places back east, they fish midge larva patterns somewhat routinely. But in the waters I tend to fish, that's not common, and I tend to not do that unless midges are hatching. Now, when they're hatching, I target them mostly with pupa patterns. But the larva are down there, and they are drifting, and fish are eating them all the time. They're particularly important for juvenile fish. The young fish trout fry, they're probably one of the most important food items out there for trout fry to eat.
Yeah.
But you could target them if you want to.
It's a big food source here in the Rockies during the winter, too.
Yes. Yeah, the wintertime, they're insects often hatching in the winter, are the midges.
Right.
And he says, you know, he's used a little thread midge out of pheasant tail and has had good success with it. And I think, again, what I would say is small is good. So if you're using a small little pheasant tail thread sort of midge pattern, that would probably work for a blue-winged olive nymph that's a size 20, as well as a midge larva or even a midge pupa. And so I think what you're doing there is you're getting a good general pattern that's small. And a good general small pattern is often going to work.
Okay. Let's see here. Chad, and this is, you may not be familiar with this, but Chad in Colorado is talking about midges too. He says, having so many different midges out there, what are three basic colors to try nymphing with or patterns? Secondly, why do pheasant tail flies always work? These are a fly that I can always catch a fish with.
Yeah. The interesting thing here is, you know, he's right on with so many different midges out there. There's over 1,000 species of midges in North American trout streams. And in any specific stream, if you did a close survey of the species present, you'd probably get more than 100 different species of midges in any one trout stream. So even picking out three basic colors is kind of challenging, because in Colorado, I'm not sure they'd be the same as here, although you're usually going to find them in a tan. And if I had three colors, I'd pick a tan, an olive, and a red would be the three I'd go with. But, you know, that's going to vary day to, you know, week to week or month to month, stream to stream. And secondly, white-tip pheasant tails always work is because, again, I think it's one of those flies that match a lot of different things. It could be matching a PMD. It could be matching a little stonefly nymph. It could be matching a small midge pupa or a small midge larva. It could be matching a blue-winged olive. So it's one of those flies that just cross lines between many different insects.
Right, right. Yeah, I noticed, you know, again, referring to that DVD that was in your book, you were kind of talking about that, you know, looking, well, this could be a this and it could be that. And, you know, one fly could represent a lot of different things. Yeah,
you tie it in
and
a different
size. In the right size area, yeah.
Yeah, and you can tie a, you know, a pheasant tail fat on a, or skinny, you know, and that can make a difference, too, in how closely it matches something. But generally, it's the size, overall size, that's going to be kind of the important thing in my mind.
I might also mention, to, for Chad's sake, we did an interview a while back with Rick Takahashi on, called Midge Secrets, and he, Rick also did a book on midges. Rick's from Colorado, so
great.
If Chad
great.
Wants to really dig into midges, I would suggest Rick's show and also his book, more specific probably to this area.
That would be excellent to check that out.
And you should see Rick's midge boxes that is in his book. You wouldn't believe him. I think he says between his boxes he's got like 1,000 midges in there or something.
Well,
like that.
And that's true when you get into lake fishing, because, you know, midge fishing in lakes, chironomid fishing on lakes is like a cult almost, especially in British Columbia and Canada. And
oh, yeah.
Alberta and stuff. I know guys that have 10 fly boxes, each filled with 800, 1,000, you know, midge patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy. Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. Bob Nunn in Ocean City, New Jersey, says, what materials might be used to best duplicate the colors trout see at varying depths, including ultraviolet and infrared spectrums?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure I'm probably the best person to answer this. I've read a little bit about, you know, this aspect of color. I have read that the colors trout respond to the best are in the reds and orange end of the spectrum. But I know as color, you know, as you go in, down in depth, the reds are going to be the first colors that decline in intensity, and blues and UVs are going to show up better at depth. And I just related, I guess, back to my thought earlier on lake fishing. I think that becomes a bigger issue because you're fishing at, you know, depths 10, 12, 15, 20 feet deep, where in stream fishing you're usually fishing, you know, less than 5 or 6 feet deep. So most of the time I just kind of relate the color pattern I'm using to the insect I'm fishing. So if I'm fishing a dragonfly nymph and they're olives and browns, I'll use olives and browns, or leech patterns, I'll use olives and browns. But I can certainly see the benefits if you're fishing quite deep. Purples and blues are good colors to fish deep in lakes because they do show up. If you're fishing a, you know, more of a reddish colored pattern at depth, it's just going to turn black. And so, you know, it'll still show up. It's just going to not look orange or red. It's going to look more black to the fish.
There you're looking probably more at, the fish is looking more at a silhouette. And going
the silhouette,
back
and then again, the behavior, you know, is it being stripped slow or fast or just loud to hang, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. running out of time here. I'm trying to pick through some of these questions here. Still got quite a few left. And we kind of talked about that. It's kind of an interesting, George in Los Angeles wants to talk. He wants to know what your best combination of dropper and lead fly. Do you fish, hopper dropper, dry fly dropper kind of combinations?
Yeah, I do. I fish two flies quite a bit, either with a dry fly and a dropper or with two nymphs. And when I'm fishing a dry fly and a dropper, I'm usually doing it during the hatch. And so one of the dry fly is usually, trying to match either a caddis or a mayfly or stone fly. And it's going to be relatively close to the natural it's coming off. And then the dropper is going to match the nymph or emerger that would be coming up for that hatch. So say if it's a March brown hatch, I'd have a size 14, harrop done on, brownish colored harrop done, and then I'd have a size 14 hare's ear nymph or something along those lines tied about 20, 24 inches dropper below the dry fly. If it's a caddis, I'd have an elk hair caddis maybe with an appropriate size color caddis pupa. So that's how I kind of, generally fish my dry fly in a dropper. Sometimes I'll do it as a searching pattern, like I'll usually do that with a grasshopper pattern in the summer, and then put a dropper with a small nymph, and that way maybe a small pheasant tail nymph like a size 16 or an 18. And that way I have the opportunity to catch a fish that's interested in the hopper or trout that are more inclined to be feeding below the surface on some nymphs. That's the way I kind of usually connect the dropper and the dry fly. If I'm fishing two nymphs, I've usually done some seining, and I've got an idea of what nymphs are dominant, and then I'll pick the two most likely, subjects based on what I saw in the stream bottom. Usually it's some combination of a caddis and a mayfly nymph or a stonefly nymph and a mayfly nymph, but it really depends on just what's most abundant out there that I see.
Yeah, that abundancy just makes me start to think, that's the good, take the most abundant and the next most abundant and
right.
And put
and
those out there.
And don't get hung up on what's the biggest and the next biggest. It's really the abundant side of it,
yeah.
Not how big they are.
Right. Right, not how big they are. Right, yeah.
Because when you look at a tray of bugs, those stonefly nymphs are just going to jump out at you.
Yeah, and you're going to go, oh, man, steak dinner.
Yeah. They'll be 10 times as many little mayflies.
Well, Rick, we've run out of time here, but so we need to cut off the question-answer part of this. But stick with me here for a few more minutes because we're going to give away your book, and I know somebody's anxiously wanting to win that. And also a couple other things, a year's membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So stay tuned with us, and we'll be put your thinking caps on for the question I'm going to ask to win Rick's book, Nymph Fishing Rivers and Streams, courtesy of Stackpole Books. Stick with us and see if you win. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women to battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving cancer, and their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and a support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and learn more about how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or call them at 866-237-5725. 866-237-5725. And just a reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You'll find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? And just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away some of our prizes, and the first prize we're going to give away here is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And this is a great organization to support and be part of. If you want to find out more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, go to their website at fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And we're going to do this drawing based upon the registration from our database, and it's going to be randomly selected for that registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show. And maybe you'll win one of these great prizes. Let's see. So our winner is going to be Thomas Berry in Ohio. Thomas Berry in Ohio. So, Thomas, congratulations on winning that one-year membership to the Federation. If you already have a membership, we'll get that extended for you as well. So, and we'll just use the email you sent in and contact you on what you need to do to collect this. Now, let's draw for the one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And if you haven't seen that magazine, you're going to want to pick up a copy. Go to probably your local fly shop or visit their website at www.flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And our winner there is Carol Owings in Idaho, Carol Owings in Idaho. And so congratulations, Carol, on winning that subscription to the magazine. Great. And now, to win Rick's book here, Nymph Fishing, Rivers and Streams by publisher Stackpole Books, which covers a lot of the things that we've been talking about tonight, right, Rick?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Yeah, so it'd be a good handy thing to have around if you want to learn more about nymphing especially. And I'm not sure really what the answer to this question is. I'd have to go back and listen to the show myself, but I'm going to let Rick decide what the right answer is.
Perfect. No one has my phone number, right?
Let's put you on the spot here. So the question is, we talked about a lot of different things that were important, especially with nymphs and other flies, size, texture, color, pattern, presentation. Which two of those are what did Rick feel were the two most important things if you were going to be particular about your designing of your flies or the tying or the selection of your flies? Which two? Size, texture, color, pattern, presentation. Which two are most important? So, Rick, the first one came in as size and color.
No, I'm not going to go with that one.
Okay.
Sorry. That's close. I shouldn't say that, should I?
I think this one, he must have anticipated my question. Here's the answer, Rick. Presentation is one of the most important parts of catching fish. Size may be the second most important factor. Most common nymph size is 16 and 18. Third is general shape of the fly, and last is color. This includes flash, which comes from air being purged from the insect's body. Can be represented by antron and other synthetic materials. What do you think?
That's great. That's great. I'm gonna have to have them write for our magazine.
Yeah. That's almost a chapter in your book there.
Yeah. Sign them up. No, that's excellent.
Okay. So the first two he said was presentation and size.
Right.
So are those?
That's those what I would agree.
The most important in your book.
Those are. Those of the list there that we had, those are the ones that I would key in on for sure.
Okay, well, Treg Owings in Moscow, Idaho, just won your book, and congratulations,
wonderful.
Treg.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that was quite complete, I think. So, size and presentation, I think that goes a lot with what we were talking about tonight. Very
and
important.
The shape of the pattern is kind of next, and color is kind of last.
Kind of last, yeah. A lot of people are always asking about color.
And, well, it's like tires. I mean, you know, when you sit down and tie a fly, you got to decide what color to tie it. So it's kind of one of those things that we spend a great deal of time in tying thinking about, but I think we spend too much time thinking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, Rick, thanks for being on the show tonight. I appreciate you taking time out to be with us and sharing your knowledge. It's been great, and I really enjoyed it, and I learned a lot.
Well, thank you, Roger. It's a pleasure doing it. I appreciate it. Thanks, everybody out there, for listening.
Well, our next broadcast will be on January 18th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and on that show we'll interview Chip Dorzensky, and the topic for the show will be River of Monsters. Chip has fished many of the great rivers in Argentina, but one of his favorites is the Lamay River, better known as the River of Monsters. Join us to discover the secrets of this river, where the average migratory browns and rainbows are 26 to 30 inches, and the trophies are 36 to 40 inches. These monsters can weigh 10 to 20 pounds and be caught in water less than 3 feet deep. This is one show you don't want to miss, so be there. We would like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Keeney's Fly Shop, for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.